This is The State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Being popular is often a priority for teenagers. Walk into any high school and you can quickly point out who is part of the in-group. Or just watch the movie Mean Girls.
Here, this map is going to be your guide to North Shore. Now, where you sit in the cafeteria is crucial because you got everybody there. You got your freshmen, ROTC guys, preps, JV jocks, Asian nerds, cool Asians, varsity jocks, unfriendly black hotties.
That's a clip from the 2004 movie Mean Girls. But our drive to be popular is not confined to high school cafeterias. Research shows that even toddlers are able to point out their most popular peers, and how liked you were in high school can influence how successful you are later in life. A new book outlines how likability and status dictate our lives. It's called Popular: The Power of Likability in a Status-Obsessed World. Joining me now is Mitch Prinstein. He's the author of the book and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. Mitch, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So this book is great. It brings back a lot of terrible and memorable junior high times for me. But I'd love to start by just sort of understanding the major framework that you set up. So there's a distinction between likability and status that's really important in how we talk about popularity.
That's right. When we're kids, we really think about popularity as far as who we like the most. Who are the kids we want to spend time with? They seem fun. They can be leaders, but really benevolent, gentle leaders who make us feel good about spending time with them. And then something happens in adolescence, something that happens in our brains and in society around us, and a new kind of popularity is born. And that's referred to as status. It's the kind of popularity that is defined by who's cool, but also can be promoted by being aggressive and dominant and making others feel worse than you or lower than you in some way. And these days, we may be getting a little confused after we graduate high school as to which kind of popularity is actually the most important.
So we're going to pick those apart in a minute, but I want to get to the why right at the top here. Why does it matter who's popular and who isn't? You've shown in your research that it actually affects our physical and mental health and even mortality.
That's right. Our likability is the type of popularity that really gives us advantages for the rest of our lives. Those people who are the most accepted, even as school-aged kids, they grow up to be happier. They grow up to make more money, be more successful in their careers, have more satisfying relationships with partners and with work colleagues, and they actually are healthier. In fact, those who are disliked are almost twice as likely to die at earlier ages than those who are well-liked. In fact, the only risk factor that seems to be as strong in predicting mortality is smoking.
So, yeah, I've seen a headline about your research that obesity isn't even as much of a problem.
Believe it or not. Yeah, that's true.
So this obviously starts really early on, and you're a scholar that's been doing this work for 20 years. Tell me about young Mitch on the playground. What did you see, and how did those early notions of social hierarchy inform the work that you do now?
I was so fascinated by popularity, even as a young kid in elementary school. I noticed that some kids really had the attention of everyone, and everyone wanted to be their friends. And I really also noticed those kids that no matter what they did, no one would pay any attention to them. And as I grew up, I definitely noticed this in myself and, saw the differences between likability and status. I was not cool. I was a geeky, kind of short-statured, bifocals-wearing kid, to the definition of not cool. But I think that I was still likable, along the way. And so that distinction became really salient to me. And as I went on to do my work as a psychologist and a researcher, I became fascinated to see that likability and status actually lead to completely opposite outcomes.
So talk about how likability can transcend environments. There are studies that take kids who know each other, go to the same preschool, they rate each other and how likable they are. Then you remove them from that environment, have them interact with different kids, and still within a few hours or a few days or weeks, people sort of self-segregate into these same likability groups. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, it was researchers right here in the Triangle at Duke University that did exactly that. They scrambled kids together who had never interacted before, and those who were most accepted in their old setting became accepted all over again in just a matter of 3 hours. And that most rejected kid, they became the most rejected kid again just 3 hours later.
So what are these factors that make someone likable or rejected or neglected?
Well, believe it or not, it has nothing to do with whether you're extroverted or introverted. In fact, the kids who were the most talkative were equally likely to become rejected, accepted, or another group called controversial, which is equally liked and disliked. And what they found was that there really is a very subtle and important way that you interact with others non-aggressively. In fact, you're wanting to join the group and navigate the group from within. That's what makes a leader and an accepted person. But then there were those who try to dominate the group, get them to, you know, acquiesce to their own ideas and ways, or try to intimidate them into doing what they wanted to do. And that's a pretty quick way to become rejected.
So once you enter a new environment, you're still communicating with others in a way that sort of asserts this hierarchy all over again.
Absolutely. It seems that kids who acted in a way that got them rejected in one school changed into a new playgroup, acted in the same ways, and found that they suffered the same fate or enjoyed the same fate very quickly.
So what's going on with bullies? You say that there are two different types of bullies, and understanding this distinction is important.
Yeah, I mean, bullying is known to be a classic way to try and increase your level of status, not like ability, but your status, by making others feel lower than you on that hierarchy. Bullies use a form of aggression called proactive aggression, which means that it's strategic, it's cold-blooded, it's calculated, and bullies will even tell you that those that are particularly insightful about their behavior will tell you they pick on others lower than them on the hierarchy, and by pushing them lower down, it makes them seem higher up and it increases their status. This leads to short-term gain. They, in fact, are able to get more access to resources or, you know, seem more cool by others, but people don't like them. They're actually quite disliked.
So how much of this is in our control, is in a parent's control, and how much of it is just inherently, this is what your personality is, this is who you are?
That's a great question, because so much of this is within parents' control. I think it's really important that parents think about how much they're helping their kids to learn about social interactions, and how much, most importantly, the way that they're teaching their kids is appropriate for their kids' age. There's some really interesting work that shows that parents sometimes engage in behaviors like monitoring what their kids do or coach what their kids do, and the same behaviors that might work for a three-year-old will totally backfire when that kid is just a couple of years older. So it's really important that parents are active, but they're really aware of what their kids are capable of, and they're not over-coaching.
And how does this cross along racial and ethnic lines? Are there differences that we see there?
There's remarkably not as many differences across different areas of diversity. You know, there's something universal about these ways of being likable, but there is a really interesting piece that happens with folks who are part of a numerical minority, which in a lot of American societies means they're also part of a racial or ethnic minority, where you can be popular within your ethnic group, but not popular within the overall school context, or vice versa.
So then, I mean, if you go to a school where you're the only kid of that certain group, it's going to be more difficult for you.
Absolutely.
Okay. And so then, so we talked about race and ethnicity a little bit. There's gender, and you've seen some noticeable differences in likability across gender lines. Is that right?
Well, you know, the world is a much harder place for females, it seems like, especially when it comes to this area. You know, there's been really cool research by Tone Sillison and others that's shown that for boys, it's not impossible to be really well-liked and to have really high status at the same time. In fact, that association is, you know, mild to modest. But for girls, especially as they get older, it is almost impossible to find girls who are both really, really well-liked and really high in status. In fact, the girls who are the most, you know, cool, most popular in the status form, they are often hated by their peers, especially by other female peers.
Is this the alpha girl?
Yeah. I mean, you kind of see it play out with adults as well in a way, and it becomes really hard. I think that one of the pieces of this that's really important as we think about the effects of popularity on our lives as we grow up, especially for females, is that, you know, girls are socialized to, they're supposed to, kind of air quotes, supposed to be good at their social relationships. And there's a lot of value and sense of identity that comes from being good at social relationships. That means that girls, when they're in adolescence, right at that time when they're developing their sense of identity, they're looking towards those alpha girls as a model of who they think they're supposed to be. These are very often girls who are more physically attractive, who are a little bit aggressive, who are socially a little bit strategic and shrewd. And what's difficult about that is that for some women, That means they spend their lives comparing themselves to the version of the 16-year-old they wish they had been. And that's not a great way to compare yourself to others for the long term.
So this is obviously within a bigger context of, you know, patriarchy and other dynamics at play that impact how women are interacting with their own bodies, with one another. You mentioned Joan Brumberg in your book, who did this incredible study of girls' diaries and sort of saw how their social preferences change over time. Tell me about her.
That's absolutely true. You know, the context is so important. And what Joan's work found, which is so fascinating, is that there's something about our society now, not just the difference between males and females, but for everyone, there's something that's changing us to go from caring about connections and community to suddenly a bit more of a selfish, status-oriented approach. Joan examined the diaries of young girls from the 1900s, the early 1900s, and then in more recent decades. And what she found was that, you know, 100 years ago when girls wrote in their diaries, they said they wanted to contribute to society, they wanted to help others, they wanted to be seen as kind. Well, that's not what girls write in their diaries now. It turns out that her research found that girls are writing they want to be the most attractive, they want to get the most attention, they want to seem the most popular, and they mean status. And they want to be somehow seen as better than everyone else. So it's a really interesting shift that our society has taken towards this more status-oriented popularity.
We'll talk more about that as we continue our conversation with Mitch Prinstein. He's the author of the new book, Popular: The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. He's also a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
For me to be who you be, instead of dreary who you were, well, are. There's nothing that can stop you from becoming popular.
This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. My guest today is Mitch Prinstein. He's the author of the new book, Popular: The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. He's also a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. So we've been talking a lot about likeability and dabbling a bit into this conversation of status. And I want to know why status becomes so important in adolescence. What is it that's going on in the brain that makes us so susceptible to this factor in popularity?
It's so interesting that recent research has been able to identify this. So specifically, there's a part of our brain that really seems to be activated and respond to rewards that we experience. It makes us feel good. And starting in adolescence, it really seems to activate when we get what's called social rewards. And it probably has to do with the fact that in the brain, what's happening is that we're developing receptors for two kinds of substances. One of those is dopamine, so that makes us feel really good. And the other one is oxytocin, which makes us really want to bond socially. And that's probably not an accident. You know, people who are interested in evolution say that our brains are probably developed that way because when you start adolescence, that's the time that you have to start developing some autonomy from your parents, right? You have to be somehow motivated to not live in your parents' basement for the rest of your life. So, you know, you're being pushed, almost biologically pushed, to care more about your peers. And when it comes to status, getting that kind of favorable regard, being visible, being influential, having people smile at you and look up to you is a really quick way to get a jolt of those substances and that kind of feeling in your brain of feeling really good about your social relationships. So there's an interesting perfect storm that makes us suddenly care a lot about that form of popularity in adolescence.
And these high status people at this phase of our lives make a huge impact on us. I remember in my own middle school diary, sort of at the start of every year, it's like two most popular girls, two most, like we become fascinated and sort of obsessed. Why do we care so much? And who are these high status people and what happens to them later on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it actually happens in a lot of species, not just humans, that we really look towards those most popular people. There's something very interesting and really almost primitive about our desire to kind of look towards those most popular people. You know, some say that our desire to attend to those most popular is the way of ensuring that we are in a good position in the herd by following them and kind of sticking with them and being influenced by them. It's a way of making sure we don't get left out, because if you get left out, especially if you're thinking 60,000 years ago, you know, then you might die. You might get eaten by a woolly mammoth or something. So, you know, it's important for us for survival to care about our standing within the herd and look to those trendsetters to know who to follow.
And so there have been studies, though, that have tracked these the people that are high status in these periods in middle school and adolescence, and they're not doing so great now.
No, they kind of peak too soon, some say. You know, those who have the highest status when they're in adolescence, they are a little bit aggressive. They are really invested in their level of popularity, and that's exactly who they turn out to be when they grow up. Some say that they are more likely to be developing addictions. They have unsatisfying relationships, romantic and work relationships. People don't enjoy spending time with them. Even their closest friends tell researchers that they don't enjoy spending time with them. And they tend to be overly preoccupied with, you know, maintaining that level of status well beyond high school when the world has changed in some ways. And they should probably be focusing on something more adaptive.
So you mentioned sort of how we've evolutionarily responded to these different changes and why they matter. We also, our DNA sort of encodes social rejection in a really interesting way. I know you mentioned in the book how hunter-gatherers, there's sort of this inflammatory response when you're rejected, and that has continued to today and maybe isn't evolutionarily advantageous anymore.
Yeah, it's this new finding that's kind of really exciting that says that even if you just think about, if you imagine social rejection, and of course, if you actually are rejected in some way, your body is automatically preparing you to potentially be injured. And the way it does that is it activates the systemic inflammatory response. So it actually changes the way your DNA is expressed just by thinking about social rejection. The reason why that's important is not only because there are all kinds of inflammatory diseases that we might suffer from, but there's even research to suggest that this has a feedback loop back in the brain. It changes our serotonin levels, and it can lead to our depression.
So that obviously makes me think about social media and sort of how we're having this constant response cycle with the media we're consuming. You've looked at sort of the longer history of how things changed around the 1980s and how that has impacted how we think about likability and status.
Yeah, it's interesting because some theories have suggested that our movement towards status and away from likability might have started before social media, and social media might have become the tool to scratch the itch that we were all given a little bit more of back in the 80s. It goes something like this. It was around the time that CNN started, actually, here in the States. That was around 1980 that the news changed. Instead of there being stories about news events, people were used to keep human interest in the stories for an entire 24-hour news cycle. And the people went from being illustrations of the news events to becoming more than narrative devices. They became the news themselves. Around the same time as we were invited into the living rooms of the lifestyles of the rich and famous, and suddenly those, you know, giant celluloid images that we would see of celebrities and other high-status people were in our living rooms. It seemed obtainable. It seemed that we could potentially become high-status folks. Social media started around the same time as reality TV, where, again, we got this impression that we could decide who was high-status, and maybe it could even be us. And social media was a way of us entering a social rewards lottery with every mouse click, you know, a way of thinking if you just post the right thing, then you too could get high-status, not for doing anything or having any particular talent or achievement, but simply in the same way that we've seen other ordinary people get their 15 minutes. Has social media caused this? I'm not sure it has, but it certainly is interesting how much people today use it as a way of gaining status or hoping to.
So when I'm scrolling through my Instagram feed, what is going on in my brain that is causing particular responses to particular images?
There are a couple of things that are happening in your brain, one of which we should be very worried about. Not your brain, but all of our brains. One is that, in fact, if you look at your posts and you see that it has lots of likes or retweets or kind of, you know, follows, it actually does activate that social reward center in the brain. It is an incredibly powerful mechanism. And some recent research at UCLA just showed that. But here's the scary part. It turns out that if you're shown images of things that you don't approve of, and you're shown that those images have a lot of likes attached to them, it actually makes you start to approve of those things more. That power of popularity and the power of how much it can influence even our innate preferences and beliefs We've probably seen a lot of that recently on how important social media can be, even in politics. But it's true. Just seeing that the herd has followed something makes us assume that it is a good thing, and we attribute positive things to it.
And this isn't just for small preferences like music or food. It influences our major decisions, like the housing bubble had to do with some of the same kind of psychology. Is that right?
Yeah, economists say that a lot of these kind of market bubbles really reflects an interesting phenomenon about us as humans. When we hear that something is popular, we kind of automatically assume that it must be good. And that doesn't always have to be the case, right? I mean, just because a lot of people like something doesn't mean that it is good or that you would like it. You know, we all, in fact, usually pride ourselves on our individual tastes and preferences. But there's something about hearing that something is popular that we automatically assume high quality, and it leads us to follow. And that's what market bubbles can be, this tendency for people to assume that the popularity means that whatever people are reflecting upon has higher value than it actually does. And when that goes a little haywire, that's when you see those economic bubbles occur.
And so how, you know, popularity is rooted in sort of these social dynamics, but things differ cross-culturally. I know there was a study in the book mentioned the difference between China and the United States and how our preferences are different.
Yeah, this idea that we might be really focused on this me culture, you know, we might have the market on that in Western society a little bit more than our neighbors to the east. There's not actually a word for popular in, you know, Mandarin Chinese that's quite exactly the same that we think about it here in America and in other English-speaking languages. When we did a study along with John Abella to look at popularity and what its correlates were across the two countries, we found that there was a big difference between popularity and likability here in the States, not so much in China. We also found that the more aggressive you are, the more status you get in the United States. In China, it was the exact opposite. That disrupts the communal way of living in China. So the more aggressive you are, the lower the status you have.
Is that correlated with the difference in economic systems?
It may be. There's a lot of follow-up research now happening by other labs to really look at what it is and whether there's something about that collectivistic culture or other kinds of forces that might be reinforcing that distinction.
Because it seems like in a lot of this, in Joan Brumberg's research, capitalism is sort of this invisible or not so invisible force on the side that is impacting status and how people move and compare themselves to one another.
And I agree. And I think also the way that our dependency on others in order to make capitalism work has really changed. You know, back in those 1900s, you couldn't do very much without the cooperation of your community. Even, you know, most workplaces required us to all work together in the same room, pushing the same levers, you know, simultaneously. Now, many of our office mates are usually not even in the same building or state that we're in when we're working. So there's an interesting way that that has shifted us to be much less focused on community partners and perhaps much more focused on ourselves.
Yeah. So you talked about the rise of the me culture. How does selfies impact this? What is the psychology of the selfie?
What is a selfie, right? I mean, it's amazing. We didn't have a counterpart to this in the 70s and the 80s. You know, a lot of research now is looking not only at how what we do on social media is a reflection of what it is that we're experiencing in our offline lives, but how our online experiences are brand new. There is no version of a selfie. You know, you might have tried to look good one day when you got to school or when you get to work, but you wouldn't hold around a picture and ask people to kind of explicitly endorse what you looked like in that picture all day. It's really interesting to think about the message that is being sent to today's youth and those who are in selfies. There's makeup designed for optimizing your selfie. There are articles in kids' magazines about how to have the best selfie, in photography magazines. What is the message that's being sent to kids today when they see all of this information telling them that having a good selfie and getting lots of social media attention is really presumably important and worth their time?
So I can imagine someone hearing this and walking away saying, I need to get my kids off social media. They shouldn't have a Facebook account. They can't be on Twitter What do you think? Is social media all bad? How do we practice positive relationships with these various platforms?
I really hope people don't think that, because I think that social media can be a great thing. In fact, what I think is really interesting about social media is that it perfectly confuses the difference between likability and status. Even the button to give someone status is often called the like button. It's absolutely, confused. You can use social media for ways that enhance likability and really help you socially. You can send private messages. You can really learn about folks and invest in relationships. The question is, are you using social media as a way of connecting with people? Are you basically speaking to an anonymous void with no desire to connect to whoever is on the other end of that mouse click? You know, if you're really doing this as an anonymous search for status, yeah, I'd be a little concerned. No good comes of that. There's plenty of research to say that. But if social media is used as a way to feel connected, supported, to help to get to know people more and establish real bonds with them, more power to it. I think that's great. And it could even help kids that are experiencing difficulties.
So you are a parent yourself, and a big part of this book is about parenting. Can you tell me a moment from your own life where you've seen these issues of popularity come up with your own kids, and how have you handled it?
And my kids are young. They're 7 and 5. So, you know, they're really just starting out here. But my wife and I are very invested in making sure that our kids know that when we act with our friends, we should really be invested not only in doing what makes us feel good, but in caring about whether our friends feel good. Have we helped contribute to the interaction in a way that makes everyone feel valued, important, welcome? These are the things that promote likability, and we know will help our kids. If our kids are doing things that make them feel good selfishly, or are insensitive to others' feelings, or they try to dominate as a way of kind of garnering lots of visibility and cheap laughs, that's not good, and we strongly discourage them.
And so there also is a way that the parents can mirror the bad in status seeking. And, you know, you mentioned politics earlier on. You know, we have these figures who are very focused on high status displays publicly. How do parents end up mirroring this behavior, and what kind of impact can that have?
You know, some parents think, kids are kids. You know, I don't have to worry about what they do with the other peers because that's not my department. But I disagree. I think, you know, kids are learning about these social relationships directly from their parents. They're watching how their parents interact with their friends. They're watching what it is their parents value. And most importantly, they're listening to their parents for what their parents reward. If a parent tells their kid, oh, it's great, you're getting the most invitations to birthday parties, you're getting the most attention, everyone seems to care about your entry into the room the most, that might be sending a message that is promoting a desire for status. But messages that really are more about good old-fashioned social skills could be extremely important. In fact, a lot of research shows that it's the way that parents interact with adults themselves that ends up transmitting quite powerfully to the ways that kids learn to interact with their peers.
And adults are still working this out for themselves as well. You talk sort of about the adult playground in the book. What can an adult do who's maybe always found themselves low on the likability scale and feels like it's inevitable, I'm always going to be awkward, I'm never going to quite, you know, be in this space where I have positive relationships with my peers? What can you do? What are the small changes we can make?
Yeah, you know, in some way, I think we all really feel like we're still that 16-year-old. You know, there's research that shows that who we were as 16, how tall we were, what we looked like, and our popularity, that ends up being a bigger predictor of our life today than those same variables and how they exist today, as adults. We all still view the world through our 16-year-old glasses, as it were, you know. And I think that's the first step. I think it's important for parents and all adults to really think about the person that they were and think about the biases that they still carry around today in how they interact with the world. Do you still expect rejection in moments where you no longer have to expect that? You're grown up. You're not in high school anymore. Do you still think people are being aggressive towards you, or you're feeling the need to be aggressive towards others? That's the first step. Recognizing those biases and seeing how it's affecting your parenting and how it's affecting the observations of how your kids are interacting with their friends. It doesn't take much more beyond observing that to start going down a cascade of possible changes that you can make, you know, really questioning your automatic behaviors and engaging in more adaptive behaviors, you know, things that are not assuming how others may be treating you, but opening yourself up to new experiences. And there's a lot of work on that that's talked about that for folks who are not experiencing severe difficulties. And of course, this is what's built into cognitive behavioral therapy for people who might be experiencing more severe difficulties.
Right. And there's a part of it that sort of requires a reflexive, constant assessment of your relationship to yourself and to what you're doing. I know you talked about how even in the promotion of this book, you've had to check yourself a couple times.
Right.
Am I searching for status or is this just about likability?
The status trap is really, you know, it's really addictive. It really is. And it's hard. Yeah, I've been taught to tweet and to try and tweet more actively and provocatively to get more followers. And yeah, it's really funny. I mean, I started to do that and follow the advice of the marketers. And sure enough, a couple people might have started to follow and they themselves had, you know, thousands or millions of followers. And I thought, oh, well, now if I tweet something specifically to get them to retweet it, then all their followers will see it. Oh, no, here we go. You know, this is exactly what to avoid if you start interacting with the world in a way just to elicit retweets, just to try and engender yourself, promote favor among totally anonymous people, just to get those status buttons getting clicked. You know, that is the trap. But I get it. I get it. You know, it is addictive and it is powerful. And that's why we all have to be pretty vigilant and watch ourselves.
Well, we'll tweet about you. I don't know how big of a boost that's going to give you, but we will. My guest today is Mitch Prinstein. He's the author of the new book, Popular: The Power of Likeability in a Status-Obsessed World. He is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a conversation with an up-and-coming Broadway star. Ariana DeBose was in the ensemble of the hit musical Hamilton. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
I trusted him.
Me, I loved him.
And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him.
There's a million things I haven't done, but just you.